Vicky Camberwell listened to Gareth, fascinated despite herself. She knew that this was the cobra dance before the chicken. She knew herself well enough to realize that part of the attraction he held for her was the very devilry and roguishness she had so readily recognized. There had been others like this one. Her job took her to the trouble spots of the world, and men of this breed were attracted to the same hot spots. With these men, there was always the excitement and danger, the thrill and the fun. But inevitably, there was also the sting and the pain in the end. She tried not to respond, wishing the ride would end, but Gareth's sallies were too much for her, and as the rickshaw drew up in front of the Royal Hotel entrance, she could not resist the almost suffocating urge to laugh. She threw back her head, shaking her shining pale hair in the wind, as she let it ring out. Gareth had learned also to use the calibre of a woman's laughter as a yardstick. Vicky laughed with an unaffected gaiety, a straightforward physical response that he found reassuring, and he took her arm possessively as he helped her out of the rickshaw. He showed her through the royal suite with a proprietorial air. "Only one suite in the place. Balcony looks out over the gardens, and you get the sea breeze in the evening. And only private loo in the building. Even one of those French jobs for sluicing the old privates, you know. And beds, quite extraordinary. Like sleeping on a cloud and all that rot. Never experienced anything like it." "Is this where I am to stay?" Vicky asked, with a small girl innocence. "Well, I thought we could make some sort of arrangement, old girl." And she was left with no doubts as to the type of arrangement Gareth Swales had in mind. "You are very kind, Major," she murmured, and crossed to the handset of the telephone. "This is Miss Camberwell. Major Swales is vacating the royal suite for me. Please have a servant move his clothes to alternative accommodation."
"I say!" gasped Gareth, as she covered the mouthpiece and smiled at him.
"It's so sweet of you." Then she listened to the manager's voice. "Oh, dear," she said. "Well, if that's the only room you have vacant, it'll just have to do then. I'm sure the Major has experienced more uncomfortable billets."
When Gareth saw the room that was now his, he tried honestly to remember humbler and less comfortable billets. The Chinese prison in Mukden had been cooler, and not placed directly over the boisterous uproar of the public bar, and the front-line dugout during the winter of 1917 at Arras had been more spacious and better furnished. The next 3 days, Gareth Swales spent at the harbour, drinking tea and whisky in the office of the harbour master, riding out with the pilot to meet every new vessel as it crossed the bar, jogging in a rickshaw along the wharf to speak with the skippers and dhows and luggers, rusty old coal burners and neater, newer oil burners, or rowing about the harbour in a hired ferry to hail the vessels that lay at anchor in the roads. His evenings he spent plying Victoria Camberwell with charm, flattery, and vintage champagne, for all of which she seemed to have an insatiable appetite and complete immunity. She listened to him, laughed with him, drank his champagne, and at midnight excused herself prettily, and nimbly sidestepped his efforts to press her to his snowy shirt front or get a foot in the door of the royal suite. By the morning of the fourth day, Gareth was understandably becoming a little discouraged. He thought of taking a bucket of Tusker out to Jake's camp and cheering himself up with a little of the American's genial company. However, he did not relish having to admit failure to Jake, so he fought off the temptation and took his usual rickshaw ride down to the harbour. During the night, a new vessel had anchored in the outer roads, and Gareth examined her through his binoculars. She was salt-rimed and dirty, old and scarred, with a dark, nondescript hull and a ragged crew. But Gareth saw her rigging was sound, and that although she was schooner-rigged with masts which could spread a mass of canvas, yet she had propeller drive at the stern. Probably she'd been converted to take a diesel engine under the high poop. She looked the most likely prospect he'd yet seen in the harbour. Gareth ran down the steps to the ferry and exuberantly tipped the oarsman a shilling over his usual fare. At closer range, the vessel seemed even more disreputable than she had at a distance. Paintwork proved to be a mottled patchwork of layer peeling from layer, and it was clear what the sanitary arrangements were aboard. The sides were zebra-striped with human excrement. Yet closer still, Gareth noticed that the planking was tight and sound beneath the execrable paint cover, and her bottom, seen through the clear water, was clean copper and free of the usual fuzzy green beard of weed. Also, her rigging was well set up. On all sheets had the bright yellow colour and resilient look of new hemp. The name on her stern was in Arabic and French, Hirondelle, and she was Seychelles registered. Gareth wondered at her purpose, for she certainly was a ringer, a thoroughbred masquerading as a cart horse. That big bronze propeller would drive her handily, and the hull itself looked fast and sea-kindly. Then, as he came alongside, he smelled her, and knew precisely what she was. He'd smelled that peculiar odour of polluted bilges and suffering humanity before in the China Sea. He'd heard it said that it was an odour that could never be scarred from a hull. Not even sheep dip and boiling salt water would cleanse it. They said that on a dark night the patrol boats could smell a slaver from over the horizon. A man who made his daily bread buying and selling slaves would be unlikely to balk at a mere trifle like gun running, decided Gareth, and hailed her. Ahoy! Hirondelle! The response was hostile. The closed, dark faces of the ragged crew stared down at the ferry. There were a mixed batch, Arab, Indian, Chinese, Negro, and there was no answer to his hail. Standing in the ferry, Gareth cupped his hands to his mouth and, with the Englishman's unconscious arrogance that assumes all the world speaks English, called again. I want to speak to your captain. Now there was a stir under the poop, and a white man came to the rail. He was swarthy, dark sunburned, and so short that his head barely showed above the gunwale.
What do you want? You police, eh?
Gareth guessed he was Greek or Armenian. He wore a dark patch over his one eye, and the effect was theatrical. The good eye was bright and stony as water-washed agate. No police, Gareth assured him. No trouble, and produced the whiskey bottle from his coat pocket and waved it airily. The captain leaned out over the rail and peered closely at Gareth. Perhaps he recognised the twinkle in the eye and the jaunty piratical smile that Gareth flashed up at him. It often takes one to know one. Anyway, he seemed to reach a decision, and he snapped an order in Arabic. A rope ladder tumbled down the side.
Come, invited the captain.
He had nothing to hide. On this leg of his voyage, he carried only a cargo of baled cotton goods from Bombay. He would discharge this here at Dar es Salaam before continuing northwards to make a nocturnal landfall on the Great Horn of Africa, there to take on his more lucrative cargo of human wares. As long as the merchants of Arabia, India, and the East still offered huge sums for the slender black girls of the Danakil and Gala, men like this would brave the British warships and patrol boats to supply them. I think we might drink a little whiskey together, talk about money. Gareth greeted the captain. My name is Swales. Major Swales. The captain had trained his oiled black hair into a queue that hung down his back. He seemed to cultivate the buccaneer image. My name is Papadopoulos. He grinned for the first time.
And the talk of money is sweet like music.
He held out his hand. Gareth and Vicky Camberwell came to Jake's camp in the mahogany forest bearing gifts.
This is a surprise,
Jake greeted them sardonically as he straightened up from the welding set with the torch still flaring in his hand.
I thought you two had eloped.
Business first, pleasure later. Gareth handed Vicky down from the rickshaw.
No, my dear Jake, we've been working hard.
I can see that. You look really worn out with your labours. Jake doused the welding torch and accepted the bucket of Tusker beer. He broached two bottles immediately, handing one to Greg and lifting the other to his own lips. He wore only a pair of greasy khaki shorts. When he lowered it, he grinned. But what the hell? I was dying of thirst, and so I forgive you.
You have saved our lives, Major Swales and Miss Camberwell,
agreed Greg, and saluted them with the dewed bottle.
What on earth is this?
Gareth turned to inspect the massive construction on which Jake and Greg had been working, and Jake patted it proudly.
It's a raft.
He circled the complicated platform of empty oil drums with its decking of timber slats, indicating its finer features with a half-empty beer bottle.
Armored cars can't swim, and we have to land them on a shelving beach. It's unlikely we'll be able to get within 100 yards of the shore. We'll float them off.
Vicky was looking at the fine muscling of Jake's shoulders and arms, at the flat belly and the dark pelt of hair that covered his chest, but Gareth was fascinated by the crudely constructed raft.
I was going to talk to you about landing the cars and suggest something like this, Gareth said,
and Jake lifted an eyebrow at him in disbelief.
All we must make sure of is that the vessel that lands us has a derrick strong enough to swing the cars outboard.
What do they weigh?
5 tons each.
Fine.
The Hirondelle can handle it.
The Hirondelle?
The vessel that's transporting us. So, you have been working, Jake laughed. I would never have believed it of you. When do we sail?
Dawn, day after tomorrow. We'll load during the night, not wanting to advertise our cargo, and we'll sail at first light.
That doesn't give me much time to teach Miss Camberwell to drive one of the cars.
Jake turned to her now, and once again felt the thrill of looking into those speckled eyes of green and gold.
I'm going to need a deal of your time.
That's one thing I've got plenty of at the moment. For Vicky, the interlude in Dar es Salaam had served to rest tired and strained nerves. Her previous assignment at Geneva had been irksome and wearying. She'd spent the last few days exploring the ancient port and writing a 2,000-word filler on its origins and history. She'd enjoyed Gareth Swales' attentions and the byplay of avoiding his more serious advances. Now she was becoming aware of Jake Barton's smouldering admiration. Nothing like being pursued by two tough, dangerous, and forceful males to relax a girl, she thought, and smiled at Jake, enjoying his reaction, and watching Gareth Swales bridle and move in to intervene.
I can give Vicky a bit of instruction on the jolly old machines. I don't want to take you off important work.
Vicky did not turn her head, but went on smiling at Jake.
I think that's rather Mr. Barton's department, she said.
Jake, said Jake.
Vicky, said Vicky.
The whole business was turning out very well indeed. A good story to chase, a worthy cause to support, another daring escapade to add to the blooming lustre of her reputation. She knew none of her colleagues had dared the League's sanctions and violated international frontiers with a gang of gunrunners to file a story. As a bonus, there were two attractive males for company. It all looked very good indeed. Just as long as she kept it all on a manageable basis and did not let her emotions get in an uproar once more. They followed the path down through the mahogany forest, and she smiled secretly to herself as she watched Gareth and Jake jockeying for position beside her. However, when they reached the clearing, Gareth stopped abruptly.
"What now?" he demanded.
"The paint job is Greg's idea," explained Jake. "Make people think twice before they start shooting at us." The four vehicles were now painted a glistening, snowy white, and the turrets were emblazoned with a flaming scarlet cross.
If the French or the Italians try to stop us, we're a unit of armored ambulances of the International Red Cross. You, Greg, and I are doctors, and Vicky is a nursing sister. My God, you have been busy. Vicky was impressed. Also, the white paint will be cooler in the desert, Greg explained seriously. They call it the Great Burn, with good reason.
The carrying sacks, racks I designed, said Jake. Each vehicle will be able to carry 2 40-gallon drums of gasoline and one of water at the rear of the turret. The crates of arms and ammunition we will distribute between the four of them and rope them down here across the sponsons. I've welded cleats here to take the ropes.
The crates will be a dead giveaway, objected Gareth. They're all marked.
We'll plane off the marking and relabel them as medical supplies, Jake told him. Then took Vicky's arm.
I've chosen this one for you. She's the most docile and friendly of the four.
Do they have characters of their own?
Vicky teased him, and laughed at the seriousness of his reply.
Just like women, my iron ladies.
He slapped the nearest machine. This one is an absolute darling, except that her rear suspension is slightly out of alignment, so she waggles her bottom a bit at speed. Nothing serious, however. But it's why her name is Miss Wobbly. She's yours. You'll grow to love her.
Jake walked on and kicked the tire of the next car.
This one is the bitch of the party. She tried to break my wrist the very first time I ever cranked her. She's known as Priscilla the Pig. I'm the only one who can handle her. She doesn't love me, but she respects me. He moved on. Greg has chosen this one. He called her the Tenastalin, which means God is with us.
I hope he's right, but I doubt it. Greg's a bit funny about that sort of thing. He tells me he was going to be a priest once.
He winked at the youngster.
Gareth, this one is yours. She has a brand new carburetor. I think it's only fair you should enjoy her, since you are the one who risked all to obtain it.
Oh?
Vicky's eyes lit with interest.
The news hound in her aroused. What happened?
It's a long story, Jake grinned. But it involved a long and dangerous ride on a camel.
Gareth choked on a lungful of cheroot smoke and coughed. But Jake went on remorselessly.
She shall therefore be known in future as Henrietta the Hump. The Hump, for short.
How very cute, said Vicky.
After midnight, the four vehicles moved in column through the dark and sleeping streets of the old town. The steel shutters were closed down over the headlights, so that only a narrow strip of light was thrown forwards and downwards. The engines were idling as they moved at walking speed under the trees, whose spread branches hung over the road and hid the stars. The silhouette of the cars was drastically altered by the burden that each of them carried. Drums and crates, coils of rope and netting, trenching tools and camping equipment. Gareth Swales led the column, freshly shaven and dressed in grey flannel Oxford bags and a white jersey, with the Zingari cricket colours adorning the neck and cuffs. He was mildly concerned that the proprietor of the Royal Hotel might become aware of his imminent departure, for there was a bill for 3 weeks' board outstanding and a formidable pile of unpaid chitties, signed with a Swales flourish for champagne supplied. Gareth would definitely feel happier out at sea. Gregorius Mariam followed him closely. His hereditary title was Gezemach, commander of the left wing, and his warrior blood coursed through his veins, mingling with the deeply religious Old Testament teachings of the Coptic Christian Church, so that his eyes shone with an almost mystic fanaticism, and his heart soared with a young man's fierce patriotism, for he was still young enough and inexperienced enough to look on the dirty, bloody business of war as something glamorous and manly. Behind him came Vicky Camberwell, driving Miss Wobbly with competence and precision. Jake was delighted with her ability to judge the engine beat and to mesh the ancient gears with a light touch on clutch and stick. She too was excited by the prospect of adventure and new experience. That afternoon,
she'd filed her preliminary report, dispatching 5,000 words by the new airmail service that would deposit them on her editor's desk in New York within 10 days. She'd explained the background, the clear intent of Benito Mussolini to annex the sovereign territories of Ethiopia, the world's indifference, the arms embargo. "Do not delude yourselves," she'd written, "into the belief that I am crying wolf. The wolf of Rome is already hunting. What is about to happen in the mountains of northern Africa will shame the civilized world." And then she'd gone on to expose the intention of the great nations to prevent her reaching the embattled empire and reporting its plight. She'd ended the dispatch, "Your correspondent has rejected the restriction placed upon her movements and her integrity. Tonight, I've joined a group of intrepid men who are risking their lives to defy the embargo and to carry through the closed territories a quantity of arms and supplies desperately needed by the beleaguered nation. By the time you read this, we shall have failed and have died upon the desert coast of Africa, which the natives fearfully call the Great Burn. Or we shall have succeeded. We shall have landed by night from a small coasting vessel and trekked through hundreds of miles of savage and hostile territory to a meeting with an Ethiopian prince. I hope that in my next dispatch I shall be able to describe our journey to you. But if the gods of chance agree otherwise, at least we shall have tried." Vicky was very pleased with the first article. In her usual flamboyant style, she particularly liked the trekking bit, which gave a touch of local colour. It had everything: drama, mystery, the little guy taking on the big. She knew that the completed series would be a giant, and she was excited and aglow with anticipation. Behind her, Jake Barton followed. He listened with half his attention to the engine beat of the pig. For no apparent reason, except perhaps a premonition of what awaited her, the car had that night refused to start. Jake had cranked her until his arm was cramped and aching. He'd blown through the fuel system, checked the plugs, magneto, and every other moving part that could possibly be at fault. Then, after another hour of tinkering, she'd started and run sweetly, without giving the slightest hint of what had prevented her doing so earlier. With the other half of his attention, he was mentally checking out his preparations, knowing that this was his last chance to fill any gaps in his list. It was one hell of a long trail from Mondi to the wells of Chaldi, and not many service stations on the road. The pontoon raft of drums had been stowed aboard the Hirondelle that afternoon, and each car carried its own means of sustenance and survival, a load which taxed their ancient suspensions and bodywork. Thus, Jake's conscious mind was fully occupied, but below that level was a gut memory that tightened his nerves and charged his blood with adrenaline. There had been another night like this, moving in column in the darkness, with the throttled back engine beat drumming softly in his ears. But then there had been the glow of starshell in the sky ahead, the distant juddering of a Maxim firing at a gap in the wire, and the smell of death and mud in his nostrils. Unlike Gregorius Maiorim in the car ahead, Jake Barton knew about war and all its glories. Papadropoulos was waiting for them on the wharf, carrying a hurricane lamp and dressed in an ankle-length greatcoat that gave him the air of a down-at-heel gnome. He signalled the column forward, waving the lamp, and his ragged crew swarmed off the deck of the Hirondelle onto the stone wharf. It was clear that they were accustomed to loading unusual cargo in the middle of the night. As each car was driven forward, it was stripped of its burden of drums and crates. These were stowed separately in cargo nets. Then they thrust sturdy wooden pallets under the chassis of the car and fixed the heavy hemp lines. At a signal from Papadopoulos, the men at the winches started the donkey engines and the lines ran through the blocks on the booms of the derricks. The bulky cars rose slowly and then swung inboard. The whole operation was carried out swiftly, with no raised voices or unnecessary noise. Only a muttered command, the grunt of straining men,
the muted clatter of the donkey engines, and then the thump of the cars settling on the deck.
"These fellows know their business." Gareth watched approvingly, then turned to Jake.
"I'll go down to the harbour master and clear the bills of lading. We'll be ready to sail in an hour or so."
He sauntered away and disappeared into the shadows.
"Let's inspect the accommodation," Jake suggested, and took Vicky's arm. "Looks like a regular Cunarder."
They climbed the gangplank to the deck, and only then did they get the first whiff of the slave stench. By the time Gareth returned from his nefarious negotiations with bills of lading, showing a consignment of 4 ambulances and medical supplies to the International Red Cross Association at Alexandria, the others had made a brief examination of the single, tiny, odoriferous cabin which Papadopoulos had put at their disposal, and decided to leave it to the cockroaches and bedbugs which were already in residence.
"It's only a few days sailing. I think I prefer the open deck. If it rains, we can take shelter in the cars."
Jake spoke for all of them, as they stood in a group at the rail, watching the lights of Dar es Salaam glide away into the night, while the diesel engine of the schooner thumped under their feet, and the sweet, cool sea breeze washed over the deck, cleansing their nostrils and mouths of the slave stench. Vicky was awakened by the brilliance of the starlight shining into her face, and she opened her eyes and stared up at a sky that blazed with the splendours of the universe, as fields and seas of pearly light swirled across the heavens. Quietly, she slipped out of her blankets and went to the ship's rail. The sea was lustrous, glittering, sable. Each wave seems to be carved from some solid and precious metal, bejewelled by the reflections of the starlight, and through it the ship's wake glowed with phosphorescence like a trail of green fire. The sea wind was the touch of lovers' hands against her skin, and in her hair the great mainsail whispered over her head, and there was an almost physical ache in her chest at the beauty of this night. When Gareth came up silently behind her and slipped his arms about her waist, she did not even turn her head, but lay back against him. She didn't want to argue and tease. As she herself had written, she might soon be dead, and the night was too beautiful to let it pass. Neither of them spoke, but Vicky sighed and shuddered voluptuously as she felt his hands, smooth and skilful, slide up under the light cotton blouse. His touch, like the wind, was softly caressing. Through their thin clothing, she could feel the warmth and resilience of his flesh pressed against her, feel his chest surge and subside to the urgency of his breathing. She turned slowly within the circle of his arms and lifted her face to his as he stooped, meeting his body with a forward thrust of her lips. The taste of his mouth and the musky male smell of his body hastened her own arousal. It took all her determination to tear her lips loose from his and to draw away from his embrace. She crossed quickly to where her blankets lay and picked them up with hands that shook. She spread them again between the dark supine forms of Jake and Gregorius, and only when she rolled herself into their coarse folds and lay upon her back, trying to control her ragged breathing, was she aware that Jake Barton was awake. His eyes were closed, and his breathing was deep and even, but she knew with complete certainty that he was awake.